Welcome back to 2021, everyone. I hope you had a safe and easy holiday season. I had kind of a crazy month off the end of 2020, which has led me into the wild start of 2021. But enough about me, and on to the episode today. Today we have Kevin Sammy, who is a very good childhood friend of mine and an overall very interesting person. Kevin has held jobs in the private and public sector in the US, but in trying to find out what he was up to, I had actually drawn a blank because I didn't find him on social media. So I thought, why don't I just ask him why he's invisible or unfriended me or just not on these platforms? He told me why and how the reason was far more important for our world today, especially due to the events on and after January 6, 2021. Just a heads up, we recorded this conversation with a lot of technical difficulties the first time, so we just redid it another day. You'll see in our quite cavalier introduction. Sorry that we have to do this again. That's never fun to have to repeat a conversation.
Oh, you know me, I really just don't like talking, so it's a big problem for me.
How was your weekend and your week since we last spoke?
So, yeah, I mean, last time we covered this big and relevant topic of misinformation, and I'm just referencing that that's when we spoke last and what we spoke on, because just within the last few days, there has been activity that is nationally and globally relevant on this topic. And so, yeah, it's been a busy week.
Yeah. I realized that I didn't actually properly introduce you and we just started talking, but Kevin, you're the brother of Kunnan, who was on the show last year. He talked about his motorcycle accident. You had a shout out in a moment where you're apparently angry with him for continuing to ride a motorcycle. And we actually are recording this again because our first go had a bit of a technical snafu. So we're just going to dive sort of into this, and it's going to start with my obviously basic question to you, which is, where are you on social media? I haven't seen you posting anything in a while. What's going on?
Oh, haha. Well, yes. Thanks for having me on. I just want to say, yes, indeed, I am the brother of Kunnan, and I am so happy you guys spoke, and I myself got so much out of listening to that episode, and just really credit your approach and you know, our kind of collective friendship having all grown up together. So I'm just happy to be here. I'm also glad we're talking, because this is the only way that we can catch up because I am not on social media. I have effectively sworn off the platforms. What otherwise started as, geez, this doesn't feel good for my mental health, and there's a lot to even just discuss there, doesn't feel like an effective kind of way to live life moment to moment or day to day, has really become to me a place that is the breeding ground for a backslide in democracy working. And so, yeah, I'm not on any of the platforms.
It's interesting you say like social media and mental health. I think I've taken a bit of a break on social media in my life before, and the idea of missing out on everything, which was my fear, you know, what updates people are going to have, didn't really happen. Like, the world kept spinning and I learned what I needed to learn from people. But diving then into the greater impact of social media with like the election and democracy and it sounds a lot like the Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma, the one that I just watched recently. I know we've talked about this before, so can you just give us like a brief rundown of what the general sense of social media is on our lives?
Yeah, absolutely. The Social Dilemma really does some heavy lifting here. And what I will credit them for, and what I'm happy is a product of this, is this exact kind of conversation. I won't rehash the entire documentary. It's well done in how it describes the problem. And the gist of it is, there are some technologists and social media or social interaction platform builders who very much so were successful in the commerce of social media, basically talking about how the algorithms that are effective in making money are effective in driving profits are also very effective in incentivizing people to click on and share things that aren't true. that are extreme. And in fact, dare I say that they're actually more likely to share that type of content in some cases, which is obviously very problematic when you need some semblance of a baseline truth.
Hang on there. Let me just back up a second here. The untruth, the fake news of our world, if you will, is it so simple to just say that people who see alarming and or infuriating content, whether or not it's true or false, it means that they will post it, share it, basically involve themselves in the social media of it more? So is that kind of where like people who think vaccines cause autism and where deniers of climate change and just generally fake news is coming from? Is it all like social media that's really been the culprit?
It's such a poignant question because, so let me give a simple answer and then a little bit of context. So is the intention of social media to create disinformation, misinformation, or create false narratives? The answer is no. I remember talking to a colleague of mine who wrote speeches for President Obama. I myself was in the Obama administration as a communications pro and speechwriter, so that's where how I know him. And he wrote speeches for Mark Zuckerberg for a time. And I remember him telling me a few years ago, look, Facebook isn't in the business of putting their thumb on the scale, right? So the short answer is, are they originators of lies? The answer is no. However, they are built to function as a well-oiled machine to propagate cynicism and lies that are created by others for the sake of what that propagation means for their profit model. So they may not be the one that's sort of pointing the ballistic weapon at the innocent people, but they're profiting gloriously from creating the fuel and building the carbon fiber body, et cetera. You know, so it's less about intention and more about just the reality of where we are. This is a true digital tragedy of the commons that can only be solved by the public.
I think I hear a bit of your Obama era speech writing coming out in that answer. It was very poetic, and I realize now how much I miss a poetic speech from somebody in power. It's been too long. But let's be real, like, can you give us like a plain words answer to that? Or an example. Maybe that's more what I'm looking for. Like, what does that mean? What if I go to YouTube and I click on a video that is around politics right now? Like, what is a YouTube or Facebook for that matter showing me that is incentivizing me to do what you say? And why would they do that?
I am really sad and frustrated and motivated to act that my first reaction to this is there are so many examples. So let me just say that first. There won't be time to cover even all the big ones, but let me give you a couple. So I want to credit Avaaz, the organization Avaaz, that's done actually very incredible work in just using their own nonprofit resources to try to track disinformation and misinformation. They're one organization out there that's trying to bring some education and light to the problem space. So over the course of, and I just looked this up so I can give you some hard numbers here. Over the course of May 27th of this year and June 9th of this year, they tracked 12 different narratives, completely false narratives, that had at least 20 million estimated combined views. So these misinformation narratives that they're referring to just in this short few month period of time, again with 26 million views, is that, for example, George Floyd is still alive. Another one is Antifa groups or government officials placed pallets of bricks at protest sites to stoke violence. Another completely false narrative, Black Lives Matter activists are threatening to assassinate white families. These happen to be misinformation narratives that end up what I would say politically shared by conservatives or kind of anti-democratic or anti-progressive audiences. Look, I'm a card-carrying Democrat. I work for Barack Obama, but this is not just a one-sided issue. It happens to be the case that more conservatives are, affected by believing and spreading lies. And I can speak to that, but just to answer your question, that's just one handful of examples. You know, a few months span this year, 26 million views of complete false narratives.
I think I found a really interesting hole where I was part of this experience where I was browsing somewhere online and the article, maybe it was a Reddit or something, and I don't remember exactly what, but the article was that Breonna Taylor's boyfriend who had shot a single bullet during that shootout, that horrible encounter, actually missed, and the cops had actually shot themselves in the end, and he shouldn't have been tried for anything. It turns out that was actually quite untrue, but it was from what appeared to be a reputable news source. That, I think, to me is the biggest question mark here, which is, how can a platform like a Facebook or a YouTube allow there to be things that appear so reputable? Because if I were to go out there and publish a newspaper in New York that was called the New York newspaper and it was full of lies, inevitably someone's going to come down on me for libel or whatever. So how do you get away with all this so easily?
Again, a really good question. I mean, there's a lot of existing infrastructure for regulating the proverbial public square, right? For ensuring that when we engage with each other, there is some semblance of one truth that we can at least all come to the table in good faith and have a conversation, a debate about policy, etc. There has been existing infrastructure for that for some time. And this isn't a new thing, a new phenomenon, big picture wise. And I'm going to come back to your question, but it's laying the groundwork, I realize, in this time and place and moment in history is really relevant. Back in the day, there's a guy by the name of Tim Wu at Columbia who wrote a book called Attention Merchants. And back in the day, when advertising on radio and TV just started to become a thing, advertising even in newspapers started to become a thing, a revenue source for papers, etc. I always use this example of, I think it was called Pepsodent, but a toothpaste brand that basically used some kind of acid and coarse material in the toothpaste. They said it would whiten your teeth, but of course it was actually hurting your enamel. It was tearing a layer of healthy bone off of your teeth. So when the science and the advertising all started to meet and realize that this was basically harmful, right? It was worse than snake oil salesmanship, where you're just selling, something ineffective as something effective. You're actually selling something harmful as something effective. There were rules that were put in place for this kind of activity, right? If you're selling a thing, you can't advertise in such a way that you're hiding what you're doing. And this ties into health regulations, et cetera. This is how society works, right? We now have taken that for granted in the digital space. So to come back to your question for how can Facebook let this happen, the Digital Communications Act of the 90s, when we were all figuring out the internet, has a clause that's referred to as Section 230 in the law. We've heard this discussed a lot. And what this basically does is it absolves the platform builders from the content being shared on the platform of any liability, right? So to your question about libel and slander, I can share something that says, Elvis is alive, he's living in my house, and Facebook, if I shared it on Facebook, Facebook isn't liable under 230. And what this does is it ensures the incentives for building these platforms, the development of these spaces, the digital spaces, are able to operate unencumbered and don't have to be scared of the bad actors that operate within those spaces. So, a thief goes into a mall and steals things or harms somebody, the mall doesn't have to be liable for that thief's activities. We go prosecute the person, right? Okay. So how do we actually do something or hold these guys accountable? And I'll just say something quickly and we can kind of move to more questions and get deeper if need be. But we just need to bring the digital infrastructure up to par with what we've taken for granted in the actual IRL public square. Right. We need the digital public square, whatever that may be. Unfortunately, it's bought and owned and sold by Facebook.com. Right. But we need to bring that back into ownership of the people.
Do you mind if I kind of jump back into the social media aspect of this? Because
please,
what you and I can do is we can get pretty deep into the specifics of a conversation like this. But I realize that the mechanism of it's pretty interesting to me. So the other day I followed a motorcycle shop. It's near my house in London. I just followed them on Instagram. And then I kind of noticed that the posts around what I was looking at would be like motorcycle related in a lot of ways. So sure, I followed a shop. It happened to be because I think it's a cool place and that they have like a good brunch menu. But I all of a sudden was getting all this like targeted content. I found it weird and pushy. And I would love to hear your thoughts on this theory someone told me, which was when we all noticed that Instagram and Facebook were using our microphones, someone thought, oh my God, they're listening to what we're saying. And then another sort of wizard on a podcast called Reply All, he said, they don't need to. They actually just have so much information already. They don't need to listen to you. They can sort of predict everything that you're going to do anyway. So is it that the data we're giving them is now so much more valuable than we originally thought it was?
Yeah, I think the short answer is yeah. I mean, the data sets that exist are so robust that with just a few turns of the proverbial dial, these companies have the ability to really predict not just what you're going to ask, but when you might decide to have a baby, when you are obviously with things like birthdays and anniversaries and family members and connectivity that's really even clear to assess on the surface. There's an ability to understand the context of your life that can otherwise either be converted as a sale, right? Or can be manipulated. I think that's the biggest shift from what I would call conventional paper advertising to the digital space, is there's such a online operating presence that we now have shared willingly, because if, you know, since we're not paying for these platforms, we are the product, that there is a manipulation incentive and ability. And that should be something that bothers all of us who don't have stock in Facebook.
I guess, like, how big of a problem is this at a global scale? Like, if the US is specifically what we've been talking about, you know, you and I are from America, I live in the UK, I know Brexit was really affected by the Cambridge Analytica group when they came in and tried to affect that vote. But, you know, outside of the, you know, the major powers, if you will, of the world, or the, you know, the Western civilizations, whatever word you want to use there, does this really affect anybody else?
You know, it is, I do not think a grandiose statement to say that in all modern post-World War II functioning, I use that term loosely, functioning republics, representative republics, democracies on the planet, all of Europe, United States, Canada, you know, you can go down the list, Australia. This is a problem at a massive scale. What I want to do, and I'm inclined to do, is just kind of sum this up in a few anecdotes, just to really viscerally show. The US president usurped the American Free Press with a Twitter account. That is something that we have to reckon with. With lies on Twitter, which again, these platforms, they are a place where polarization is profitable, right? And they are also a place where free speech and powerful lies can look exactly the same. So woefully unqualified human ran for president, didn't have a press team, and tweeted a bunch of crazy stuff that wasn't real. And accredited journalists suffered from the weight of that ability, right? And this guy, same dude, Donald Trump, at a presidential town hall, which was supposed to take the place of a debate, so millions of viewers, was asked a question point blank by a journalist about QAnon, a incredibly proven to be, you know, not real conspiracy theory. And he wouldn't deny that it was a fake or a conspiracy theory or you know, an untruth. And the mere fact that he's being asked that question itself shows the global scale of this problem. You know, President Obama, look, I worked for the guy, but he and none of us are perfect people. That's why we need regulations. But he said himself, and I couldn't agree more, a few hours ago, I think I read a news article, Donald Trump's a symptom of this. And I think that's the way we need to all see it. So the global scale of this problem, it's not that there are necessarily a handful of arbiters. It's we've gotten to the point where the information age has gotten too big for representative republics to handle.
It's funny because I think this episode will be on after the election. So we might be speaking in the past based on some craziness that's occurred. I know the first time we recorded this until now, there was that town hall. I think in that same town hall, he was asked why he retweeted a theory that Joe Biden and Obama had SEAL Team 6 killed to hide the fact that Osama bin Laden was still alive. And he just said, oh, I just retweeted it. It's not a big deal. Like, it's just something out there. And it shows like the sort of egregious nature. It's like you've given a toddler a bunch of dynamite and you said, like, here's a match, have some fun, without, you know, fully explaining to them what they're doing. Outside of the US, have other countries had any sort of like very obvious impacts by this?
Yeah, it's I'll be honest, I myself am much more familiar with the kind of US implications of this. I'm certain that this phenomenon is taking place in microcosms, even around this country, let alone others. And the phenomenon looks and feels okay, like on the surface. That's really one of the big problems here. I'm now intrigued to kind of go find out what British or European versions of this type of thing might be happening. I mean, QAnon is definitely a globally pervasive conspiracy theory. Child pedophilia rings and kind of elitist citizens hiding from the non-elite, these sort of secret basements of activities. Illegal activities like that just happens to be this odd kind of sticky conspiracy theory thread around the world. I will reference just two quick things that are part of this kind of powerful lies can really lead to real harm. One is WhatsApp, of course, owned by Facebook. It's a messaging platform. It doesn't have necessarily the same kind of share button, like button, Facebook group algorithmic problems that Facebook has. But we just have to toss them into the space here of what do we do with this kind of wildfire spreading of basically violent untruths, violence-inducing untruths. There's a lot of, unfortunately, branches of this story, but basically this WhatsApp group spreading notion that there were vagabonds or nomads traveling through Indian villages that were raping or kidnapping children, and a few innocent people were beaten to death in a couple of villages just because of this WhatsApp thread, strangers, right, to the people who actually killed them. Similarly, this is a big one, and I kind of encourage folks to just do some more reading about this if it's of interest or new news. But in Myanmar, Facebook is often preloaded when you walk into a little street shop to buy a phone. The shop owners will often preload Facebook. That's how pervasive it is as a communications tool and a social tool in that country. And the military used it as an incredibly effective tool to commit mass genocide. So, I mean, is the solution to turn off internet communication tomorrow? No, obviously it's not that simple. But the fact of the matter is, you can't walk into a theater and yell fire without feeling the negative ramifications for that. And we all feel safer in our communities when we know those intentionally evil people, when they do, we know that they're going to be brought to justice. Right now, there are peddlers of misinformation online that are making a lot of money and not seeing any sort of justice for the erosion of democracy that they're causing.
Here's a question that's particularly well tied to the moment that you and I are speaking. However, at published time, it might not be as important, or it might be incredibly important again. But we all know that in 2016, Russia had a pretty big arm in hacking the United States election. You and I have talked a lot about this. It sounds to me like what they could have been doing is just publishing things on a platform, not in an illegal manner, because there's no real rules around what you can publish on Facebook at this point. But my question then is, like, why doesn't anybody target them? Like, why can't the United States group of, savvy hackers go in and depose Putin and depose Xi Jinping or depose whoever else in these other countries that seem to want to affect the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, good question. I mean, first, just to double tap what you laid out as the premise there, it's really important to know, to anybody thinking about foreign interference and meddling in our elections. I mean, I've spent time at the Pentagon, and I remember this being a topic of concern, top of people's minds, and the joint staff and the policy offices at the Pentagon. Russia and China don't have to do anything illegal to manipulate American elections. That's exactly the problem we're dealing with, is there are no parameters. It is a free-for-all of win at all costs. So I will now lie through my teeth and to win, right? So Russia and China can just join that current and just stoke chaos. That is their plan, and especially Russia, and they're very effective at it. Why aren't we doing this to them? Well, if that's the question, I mean, the answer here is really, these governments are pretty well-functioning autocratic regimes. So you have a situation where in the United States, I mean, it's literally our First Amendment. If nothing else, we stand for free speech, right? Free expression. And you layer on top of that, of course, a system that's pretty broken in terms of actually being as representative as it can be. But you layer on top of that a system of government where we choose who governs us, right? We choose who governs ourselves, sort of deal. both of those are basically flipped, right, in those other regimes. So if there's any kind of technological or social media or social interactivity utilities in those countries, they're heavily controlled by the government. They're heavily controlled by the top down. And there is a really rampant censorship vector there where they're able to operate and manipulate information. So there isn't any kind of, you know, there isn't any disorder, right, in that sense. So it's pretty difficult for us to, you know, as the free world, if you will, to like influence people in those ways. I think Hong Kong's a great example of how, you know, calls for more democratic, a more democratic, at least Hong Kong government were, you know, quickly thwarted by the Chinese government. And yes, we can be over here and say, look, we, our values are democratic, but it's not like, just like we were unable to deploy, you know, actual forces to sort of help the Hong Kong citizens because of our jurisdiction, if you will. It's just, the systems don't exist there like they do here where they're open-ended.
Right. Because we're a free society, we are unable to like really prevent this unless we start taking care of the platforms that are doing it. And therefore, we can't do much to people who aren't considered free society. So like, how do we fix this? You know, what if solving this problem is a federal legislation or it's combating the tech companies or like, as Elizabeth Warren used to say, like break up big tech or whatever, like what does it look like if we fix this?
It is honestly what keeps me up at night these days. I really fear if we don't find some solution, representative democracy as we know it is on the chopping block. It is at stake. Yeah. So the good news is it is solvable. And because this is vastly a digital problem, it's fairly quickly solvable. So I want to give you the quickest answer to what we do now, and then give a little bit of a hopeful proxy, almost a, let's say, metaphorical or analogous situation or two to show how we can. And I do think that this sort of thought process that I've kind of stumbled upon is a new way to think about it, but definitely a lot of folks in this space are trying to work hard to solve this, and I'm hopeful that we can. So the answer to the question is the incentives are backwards. So the commercial incentives are definitely proven at this point to be deleterious and damaging to democratic institutions and democracy, even though they're very effective at making money. So you have this really basic problem where regulations and governing self-government of our social space and our public discourse is not sufficient when it comes to digital interaction, when it comes to social media. So what we need to do is change the incentives. It is that simple. We need to change the incentives. Does that mean we tamper free speech and we censor and we blow up these companies, shut them down, nationalize them? No, that is not what it means. And I'm going to use a couple of analogs to explain that. Now, the incentive shifting needs to go away from the tech platform and the advertisers using people as chits. It needs to shift from that to being the people having control over who advertises and how they advertise and really owning that space, right? And there absolutely can be a collaborative and transactional and kind of a negotiation there. But in the most basic sense, that is the shift in incentives that needs to happen. We see how localized governance on Reddit is effective in ensuring that subreddits feel like the content is good. It's what people expect. It's being curated by moderators, by these leaders of these like localized social groups, right? Now, those leaders aren't seeing revenue from the advertising revenue that comes through. And of course, Reddit's a little bit of a different beast because they didn't have that as a primary revenue source from day one, like Facebook. However, they are now taking money from advertisers. So Reddit is in this space of social media and advertising revenue being a big part of it. So shifting incentives is that one thing we have to do. I do think the Senator Warren thread that other people are pulling on of, you know, break up the oligopoly is definitely a approach to ensuring that these sort of titans of social media don't just have their hands on the wheel. They're not able to take the dials and profiteer off of mass manipulation. But my argument to that is, you know, this is a problem of the tragedy of the commons. It is not a problem of consolidation of commercial endeavors. So we have, for example, oligopolies in the cell phone and cable industry, right? Now, these oligopolies absolutely could use more, you know, competition. I would always argue that. However, the more cell phone towers and the existence of cell phone communication just as communication isn't destructive to democracy in the way that social media infrastructure is destructive to democracy. So the analog I want to use is environmentalism. And that is actually my regulatory and government expertise. And I was on a run this morning just realizing, like, damn, Kevin, it's like this deep government know-how of regulatorying the public space, right? Regulatorying the commons is actually why I am so adamant about this issue. And it's been done. Polluters, for example, right? Generating electricity is more than just making a product. Frankly, it's core to our existence, our lives, right? So what we've done as a society is we haven't gone and just counted on the benevolence of electricity generators and power plant owners. We sure as hell should not count on the benevolence of Mark Zuckerberg. What we did was we said, you know what? We're going to create a law. We're going to call it the Clean Air Act. And we're going to say, sure, do whatever you need to do to generate electricity and sell it to us. But if you pollute the air in these ways, it's not allowed. I don't care what you have to do. You got to fix it, right? We did the same thing with cars. We passed a law and we said the public space is the safety of the public space is worth putting parameters on the harm. You figure out how to keep doing the good, keep building the cars, keep generating electricity, but you're not allowed to do it in a harmful way. And guess what? People invented the catalytic converter. We invented and innovated ways around this. We took the incentives and we attached the right cost to the harms.
Okay. I guess like barring industrial and ground up foundational changes to the way that ad platforms are, what should we do? Me, you, anybody listening, the average human being who's not a tech CEO?
Yeah, I love that question because it's something that I keep mulling over myself. And just first and foremost, educate yourself, educate your friends, call out misinformation. Avaaz has some great channels for calling out misinformation. I referenced them earlier, and they actually have people that do the work of trying to flag that misinformation for tech platforms and other people who can get rid of it. A good friend of mine has some young kids who he said their teachers spend a lot of time trying to teach them how to identify misinformation. That's the biggest thing we can do is understand what we're looking at, because that inoculates us against the harm that this ultimately caused. That's number one. And number two, disengage from those platforms that are part of the problem. I am a firm believer that we need to write the laws that regulate society that we all decide are the laws to write. You know, that's how, why we choose the people we choose to be in office, and we count on them to make those laws. They should come from us. But in lieu of that, we are the most powerful commodity in this whole game. You know, don't kid yourselves. We're the product on Facebook. And if we all collectively with our brains and hearts revolt, then somebody will make a different product. I am hopeful that the laws and the rules will also match our intentions, but let's not kid ourselves. Our being on those platforms is what gives them the power, and we should take that away from them.
That was Kevin Sammy on the perils of social media. I've linked to some of what Kevin's been working on in the show notes if you want to learn more. After January 6th, 2021, we saw a slew of social media platforms boot the 45th president and his associated accounts off their services. During what happened in the Capitol, it was found by several journalists that social media had played a big part in coordination, planning, and execution of, let's be frank, the insurrection. Thankfully, we have a break from Donald Trump's Twitter feed, but as we said in the chat, he's the symptom and not really the problem. By constantly being told our thoughts are right and everybody else is wrong, it's really easy to get aggravated. When we see our family members writing long diatribes about one position or the other, we quickly fall out with our own relatives. Maybe the real success comes when social media gets more open and less targeted, and we're forced to see other perspectives. But until then, the best advice that I took away from this was to disengage just a little for the ever fleeting but necessary peace of mind. That's it for today's story. If you liked what you heard and want to hear more, you can subscribe to get the latest updates anywhere you get your podcasts. And if you have a moment and you're feeling generous, please leave a review. I'd really appreciate it, and it helps me understand how to make this show even better. For more info on me and this concept, you can visit our website at onesimplequestion.co. One Simple Question is hosted by me, Abhishek Lahoti. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you tune in again soon, and bye for now.